Thank you for tuning in to Talking Bay 94, the Star Wars podcast devoted to interviews with the cast, crew, and creators of a galaxy far, far away. I'm your host, Brandon Winerdy, and this is my conversation with Academy Award winner for his editing work on the original Star Wars, the legendary Paul Hirsch. From working with Brian De Palma and John Hughes, to his time in the editing bay for both A New Hope and Empire Strikes Back, we go through as much as we can of his storied career. This is Talking Bay 94, Episode 37, Paul Hirsch. Today we are talking to Academy Award-winning editor for his work on Star Wars, Paul Hirsch, also known for his incredible work on Carrie and Footloose, Mission Impossible. The list goes on and on. Mr. Hirsch, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
You're welcome.
I would love to first start, before we even talk about Star Wars, about how you got into editing itself. Growing up, what movies inspired you, and were you noticing the types of editing and camera work that were going on in those early films?
My parents moved the family to Paris when I was about 3 years old. I lived there for about 4 years. We moved back and forth a bit, but in the total was about 4 years. I came back when I was eight. And for me, going to the movies to see American movies was a way to keep a link to America.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember seeing movies in Paris that had a big impact on me. Of course, you know, you ask any seven-year-old when they come out of a movie, how'd you like it? They say, it's the best movie I ever saw.
Yeah.
I mean, because they're seven, you know?
Yeah.
So the movies I remember from Paris, in particular, one was King Solomon's Mines. Had a huge effect on me. And I think I was fascinated by the location shooting and the authentic music. There's no score in the film. It's all African drums. And I really loved that picture. And years later, I discovered that it had been edited by Ralph Winters, and he won the Academy Award for it. So there's that. And then there was a picture, An American in Paris, with Gene Kelly and Leslie Caron. And in it, Gene plays a painter. My father was a painter, and he's in love with a dancer, and my mother was a dancer. And there I was an American in Paris. So
right.
I think I saw that picture about 20 times.
Wow, yeah.
And as a kid, I always loved dancing, and I was encouraged by my mother to dance all the time. And my father played the piano, and music was really my first love. And other films, like when I got to be, you know, older, when I was a teenager and started going to movies, you know, not just the weekly issue from the studios.
Right.
Let me back up for a second. When we came back to America, we started going to Provincetown in the summers. And in Provincetown, there were two movie theaters. And they've changed their programs every 2 days.
Mm.
So Monday night, we would go to one theater, and Tuesday night, I had a friend, Ron Roos, who's also an editor and writer and educator. And he and I were kids together, and we would go to one theater on Monday, the second theater on Tuesday. By Wednesday, there was a new program at the first theater.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd go back there, and then Thursday, we'd go back to the second theater. And then Friday was one theater, Saturday was the other. And by Sunday, we were stuck because the weekend movies played for 3 days.
Uh-huh.
So we had to figure out something else to do on Sunday nights. But I spent about five summers there going to every movie that came through town. And I remember, what did we see that was impressive? The Vikings with Kirk Douglas and The Big House with Jack Palance, Blackboard Jungle. And we couldn't get in to see I Am a Camera because we weren't old enough.
Uh-huh.
I remember seeing Diabolique, which scared us. And then later on, I was living on the Upper West Side in New York, and there was a movie theater there called the Yorktown. And it was a second-run house. And they would show the distribution pattern in those days with the studio pictures that opened in Times Square and play there for a few weeks. And then after a while, they would move out to the neighborhoods, or the Nabes, as they called them. And they had the second run in the neighborhoods, and the ticket prices were cheaper. And the Yorktown was then bought by I think by a man named Dan Talbot, who called it the New Yorker. And he started a revival program there and showing pictures from the 40s, 30s and 40s and 50s, as well as some foreign films. And it was at that theater and the Thalia that I sort of got my education in more diverse films. And finally, in summer after I graduated college, I went to Paris, and Paris introduced me to the notion of directors as auteurs. And I started to learn who Howard Hawks was, and Bill Wellman, Raoul Walsh, and mm-hmm. John Ford. And so it was a gradual lifelong right. love of movies that sort of made it seem inevitable that I would wind up in the business. But I can't say that it was very special. I think a lot of children grow up loving movies.
Well, how did you make that jump then to working on movies professionally? What was that step like to becoming an actual professional editor?
When I graduated Columbia, I applied to the Columbia School of Architecture, and I was accepted. And after a couple of months there, I just thought that the work was too dry for me. And I had a friend who lived in the neighborhood who had graduated from Columbia a couple of years before me. And he was cutting a little documentary in his apartment. And I visited him, and I saw a Moviola for the first time. Mm-hmm. And this was in the era before Betamax. So the only way you could see a moving image in those days, unless you were in the business, the only way an average person could see a moving image was either at the movies or on television. And in both cases, you had no control over the film. You could only watch it forward at sound speed. There was no pause, there was no rewind, no fast forward, nothing like that. So when I saw this Moviola, and he could stop on a frame and go backward, I thought, oh my God, this is fantastic, you know. It really struck me as something like the coolest thing I'd ever seen. And he had all his equipment. He had splicers and rewinds and reels and tape dispensers and all sorts of things all over his desk, his setup for, you know, his editing bench. And I've always liked working with my hands, and that was part of the attraction for me too. So I decided that I quit architecture school and decided to try to get a job in the business. And through a friend, I got a job as a delivery boy at a company that made industrial films. They would go shoot stock car races. Today it would be called NASCAR. They'd hire 10 cameramen for the day, and they'd shoot the race. And then they'd bring all this footage back to the office, and the editors would cut together the race with a voiceover, you know, calling the race. And then at the end, they would tack on a little ad for STP or spark plugs or tires or whatever. And they would take these films. It was the same film, but different tags on the end. And they would sell them to the various companies who would use them at sales conventions to rev up their sales base, you know, their sales force. So I was working there, and I met on one of my rounds, my job was to take packages around town, and I would take cut work prints to the negative cutter, and then I would pick up cut negative and take it to the lab, and I would pick up from the lab, I would take prints and bring them back to the office. So that was my job, sort of facilitating these packages going around town. And on one of my rounds, I met a negative cutter who was looking to train somebody. Mm-hmm. And I consulted with one of the editors at the office. I said, what do you think? He said, well, at least you'll be handling film and not packages. I thought, well, that kind of makes sense. So I gave notice, and I started to work for this negative cutter, and I learned the whole technical end of the business, how you prepare negatives to go into the lab. And mm-hmm. And then after about 6 months, I really exhausted everything this guy could teach me, and the work got extremely boring. So I left. And then I managed to get a job assisting as an assistant editor, even though I wasn't technically an assistant editor, but I knew enough to get by. I went to work at this trailer house. It had been a radio spot house, and they were expanding into trailers and TV spots. And they had one editor who needed an assistant, so I became his assistant. Mm-hmm. And after a while, they were getting a lot of business, and after a while, he couldn't handle all the work. And he gave me a 10-minute featurette on the making of the Thomas Crown Affair to cut down to 3.5 minutes. So that was the first thing I did. And then the client was United Artists, and they liked my work, so they gave me one to do from scratch on Chitty Chitty Bang Bang with Dick Van Dyke.
How'd you get involved with Brian De Palma then, again, starting this long partnership with him as a director and editor combo?
Well, my brother got a job at Universal scouting, directing, and writing talent in New York City. He was always very voluble and talked his way into this job, and he met Brian, and they proposed a project to the studio, which was turned down. So he and Brian decided to produce the film on their own, my brother acting as producer, and raise some money from family, friends. And they shot a film called Greetings, which starred, among other people, Bob De Niro. Mm-hmm. So, and Brian had already worked with Bob once before on a picture called The Wedding Party. They finished Greetings. They needed a trailer for it, so they turned to me, and I cut a trailer for Greetings. And then that's how I met Brian. And he and I hit it off. And then when they got the money to do a second film, I was hired as the editor. And then I did 5 pictures for him before I worked for anyone else. And that's how I got started.
Yeah, I mean, that list of you first starting out, you know, Phantom of the Paradise and Carrie and Obsession, like just incredible, incredible movies so early on in your career. What were you learning through this process of working not only with De Palma, but on these story-driven, incredible films?
Well, you know, I never went to film school and never had any idea of going to film school. And, you know, when I graduated college, it was either law school, medical school, or business school.
Right.
And only the jocks went to business school. So architecture was sort of an outlier, and it was sort of artistic, which would appeal to me, but it was, you know, it turned out to be not what I really wanted. And film is so much livelier than that, so that's what drew me to it. But as a consequence of the way I got into the business, I never learned. I mean, I learned how to cut trailers from somebody else, but I didn't learn how to cut features except by doing it. And Brian is 5 years older than I am, so I was 23. He was 28. So we were kind of learning at the same time. He was more experienced than I, knew more, but not that, you know what I mean? We're still
right.
growing, both
right.
of us. But he encouraged me, and he empowered me, and he gave me a lot of support and encouragement. I learned by, you know, the way that amateur painters learn how to paint. They go to the Louvre or the Met or whatever, and they sit down and they copy the masters. And so what I was doing in my work was trying to turn these dailies that I had into something that looked like a movie. That was my goal. So I was sort of a passionate amateur who got a chance to work on professional films.
Well, I think you succeeded into making those look like movies.
Well, you have to give credit to Brian. I mean, I think Brian is sort of underappreciated, but maybe he's not. I don't really devote a lot of time to the film fan scene. I don't really.
Right.
I'm not deeply in touch with what critics are writing about who.
Mm-hmm.
I think that somehow other directors of his generation have gotten a lot more attention.
How did you start from working with De Palma and to then going into the editing room with Lucas? What was that transition, and how was it working with a new director like George Lucas?
Well, George came back from England after having shot his film. He was very unhappy with the cut,
mm-hmm.
and he let his editor go when he left England. And Marshall Lucas and Richard Chu were cutting the picture, and they realized that they weren't going to be able to get through it all, and they needed extra help. So I had met Marsha and George a couple of years earlier when there was a screening of Phantom of the Paradise at 20th Century Fox in L.A.,
mm-hmm.
and we chatted a little bit at a little reception, and it was an immediate, obvious kind of connection. We, you know, just on a personal level, we just sort of clicked. The following year, Marsha was working on Taxi Driver, and she called me up. She said, "Can you come out and help work on Taxi Driver?" I said, "Sure." And the next day, she called back and said Columbia wouldn't permit it because they had, you know, they weren't going to pay to bring an editor out from New York.
Wow.
And they had all these editors in L.A. So I said, "Okay," you know. So now a year later, they come back from England, and we showed them Carrie, and we just finished the cut of Carrie. Mm-hmm. And they went off to the West Coast, and we were in New York, and I got a call from Marcia and said, how would you like to come work on Star Wars when you finish Carrie? And I said, I'd love to. Am I going to get a call tomorrow saying the studio said no? She said, no, this is much different. George is in control of the process. And so I said, yeah, of course, I'd love to.
So what was that editing room like? You mentioned Richard Chu, you mentioned Marshall Lucas, and you know, historically, George Lucas is very famous for having an editor point of view and mind, and he's comfortable in the editing room. What was that process like with that team, editing which reels and which scenes?
Well, when I came on, Marcia was focused entirely on the end battle. Mm-hmm. And she was still building it at that point. And it was a tremendously complicated task. And she worked on it for many, many weeks. And Richard was recutting the reels leading up to the end battle. Mm-hmm. And which is when I got involved. And he and I would sort of leapfrog over, and when I finished the reel, I would go to the next reel, and let, you know, and then if he was working on it, I'd go to the one after that, and then so forth, you know. So we both were recutting the reels. At a certain point, George had to lock the end battle to deliver it to ILM so they could make the shots in time, and I moved from recutting the reels to helping Marcia with the end battle. We divided it up. She took the first part, which was longer, and I took the last part, which was shorter. Mm-hmm. And we worked on it together for a number of days until we finally were able to deliver a locked version of the sequence to ILM. And meanwhile, Richard was still recutting the reels.
The original Star Wars is a masterclass in terms of editing. And, of course, with the shots that were available, right, whether that they weren't finished with special effects or that they still needed John Williams' score, how did you frame that in your mind in order to edit the product to make it a lock cut?
Well, as you pointed out, George is an editor himself. You know, that was his forte in film school. And he once told me that the only reason he directed was to have film to cut. And the only reason he wrote was to have film to direct. Mm-hmm. So the whole point was to have film to cut. That was his focus. But he wasn't able to cut on the film because he was spending half of the week with ILM, getting it on its feet and up to speed, and so he would spend. He lived up north, so he, you know, Monday morning he would fly down to LA, spend 3 days with ILM, and Wednesday night he would fly back, and then Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, he would come to the editing room and work with us. So his time was really divided, you know, between the effects and the cutting. Mm-hmm. The three of us worked together for about 3 months. I think it was October, November, December. We showed the picture to the studio in December, I believe. And then at that point, Marty Scorsese was cutting New York, New York. Mm-hmm. And his editor, a guy named Irving Lerner, sadly died. And Marty had worked with Marcia before, and he called her up and said, can you come work on New York, New York? And they'd had a successful relationship working on a couple of pictures. So at that point, George decided he really wanted to continue with just one editor. And I had only been hired to the end of the year, so I didn't expect to be extended. Mm-hmm. I thought Richard was going to stay on, but apparently he had the same deal I had. And George had to choose one of us, and he chose me. Marcia went off to do New York, New York with Marty. Mm-hmm. So then January, February, March, April, and May, I was the editor on the picture. And during that time, they reshot R2-D2 with the Jawas in the canyon, and they reshot the cantina sequence.
Right.
We shot the whole build-up to the triggering of the Death Star ray. I don't know what you call it. Mm-hmm. The destructo mechanism. A lot of that material we needed because it was a key element in developing tension in the final reel, in the final end battle. And we had to create the example of it in an earlier reel so that when you saw it at the end, you would recognize what was about to happen.
With Star Wars specifically, and then moving into Empire, There was, you know, again, the special effects work and the story being told was so radically different than, you know, movies that had come before it. What were your first impressions, especially, you know, you were one of the first people to ever see completed footage of Star Wars? How were you kind of realizing that through the work that you were doing?
I wanted to watch the reels when I started, and George said, no, don't do that. Nothing is right. We have to recut it all, and then we'll, you know. So he would give me a reel to cut, and then if Richard had finished the reel, I would watch that. Mm-hmm. But he wouldn't let me look at anything that hadn't been recut. So every time I grabbed a new reel to start work on it, I would watch it and think, oh, my God, this is so good. I mean, there's so much stuff, and, you know, there's so much great, so many great scenes in every reel, and it was sort of revealed to me over the course of many weeks, because I was only seeing a reel until I finished my work on it, you know. Mm-hmm. So I didn't get to see the whole movie until we got it all recut from beginning to end, and then we kept working on it. Even then, I mean, we kept refining all the way to the last minute.
Yeah,
I mean, there was no time to look up and think about the larger implications of what we were doing. It was just busy, nose to the grindstone.
Yeah.
From morning till night, every day, you know, so.
Yeah, that's wild. What was the, do you remember what the final shot that you locked before shipping off the final cut of the movie was?
No, I don't. I can tell you a little, I don't know if this is too wonkish for your audience, but I can tell you a story that's not in my book.
I would love to hear it.
George was shooting the visual effects in VistaVision. VistaVision is a larger format. It has 8 perfs instead of 4. The idea was, when you make dupe negatives from original negative, you lose quality. And the idea of shooting the effects in VistaVision was that when you made the dupe negative, the optical negative, down to 4 perf, it would intercut better with the original negative that had been in the camera and the rest of the shooting, you know, the live-action shooting. But it wasn't clear if the quality would match. So in order to give himself flexibility, George decided that he would cut the negative in A and B rolls. A and B rolls was like a checkerboard. They'd make an A roll and a B roll, and the first shot of the negative would be cut into the A roll. The second shot of the sequence would be cut into the B roll, and opposite the B roll in the A roll would be Black Leader. So every shot was connected to Black Leader on either side. There was no shot spliced to another piece of film. It was just to another, you know, another cut of the action. Mm-hmm. So every piece of action was spliced to Black Leader on both sides. And the reason he did that was that if there was a shot that looked too good because of the higher quality of VistaVision,
right,
he could take it out of the reel, out of the A roll or B roll, whatever roll it happened to be in, take it out of the roll, make another dupe, degrading the quality further, mm-hmm, so that it would match the original negative. Okay, so the reason that we didn't just cut the negative ordinarily, which is the single strand of one shot after the other, was to avoid making what they call splice over splices. Negative cutters can open up splices and splice over them, mm-hmm, but it's not desirable because the splice is not necessarily as solid. The purpose of this exercise, the A and B rolls, was to avoid making any splice over splices. If we had to take a shot out of the roll, dupe it, and replace it with the lower quality dupe. So our negative cutter, in assembling these A and B rolls, made 2 mistakes. One mistake was he used the wrong kind of black leader. There are 2 kinds of black leader. There's positive and there's negative black leader. They're both black, but the perforations on positive black leader are kind of rectangular, and the ones on negative black leader are more oval, and they fit more snugly against the sprockets for tighter and more secure control, because it's negative. You don't want it to rattle around. Well, he used the wrong kind, so in order to... In order to avoid making any splice over splices,
uh-huh,
It turned out that because of his mistake, we had to make a splice over splice on every single shot in the reel. His second mistake was there are two kinds of splicers for 35 millimeter film. One was for ordinary 35, and the other was for, you know, CinemaScope or widescreen, where the overlap of one film one piece of film to the other is narrower than on ordinary 35. Mm-hmm. So that the splice, when it comes up, when it's projected, is invisible because it's narrow. Well, he used the other kind of splicer, that where the splice is broader. So after he had done his resplicing with the correct negative and they projected it, you could see every splice as it went through. Then they had to print reel one with a mat that would mask these bad, you know, the splices that were visible because he had used the wrong kind of splicer. So if you were to measure it, I suppose the vertical height of each frame in reel one would be less than all the other reels in the movie, but not noticeably, obviously.
Right. After 40 years, yeah, no one picked up on it. I guess then moving to Empire, right? So you and Marcia and Richard Chu win an Academy Award for your incredible work on Star Wars, and then you move on to editing Empire. What lessons did you learn, whether it's editing the special effects or working directly with George and Marcia, of course, uncredited? What did you then take to the Empire editing bay?
Well, let's see. I don't know. I had done two pictures in the interim, so I was still, you know, developing my chops, working with a new director, Kirshner. Mm-hmm. And it was a different experience because, first of all, I was involved from the get-go. I was there from day one. And the design of Empire was very bold. After Star Wars, any studio executive would have had us do a clone of the first film with, you know, a big right. battle at the end. And George decided he wasn't going to do that. And the big battle scene in Empire is at the beginning. So that was really daring, and I don't think he gets enough credit for that. I don't think he gets enough credit for what he's done, to tell you the truth. For some reason, people like to beat up on him, but I think it's terrible. But it was a bold move, and Kirshner was an experienced director who dug down with the actors to make the characters come alive much more than George had in the original right. film, because right. that's not really George's forte, right. you know.
Yeah.
But Kirshner got some wonderful character stuff out of the Wookiee and his relationship with Han and of course with Leia, and Marcia came in and cut a scene between Harrison and Leia, which George felt needed a woman's touch. Mm-hmm. But Kirsch was a stickler for things, and he for various reasons, the picture went over schedule. Mm-hmm. And every couple of weeks we'd say, you know, instead of going back on this date, we're going to go back 2 weeks later. And then it kept getting extended. It was like a moving horizon, you know. And finally, we wound up at the end. The picture wound up shooting 13 weeks over schedule. No, that's not true. No, that is true. We were scheduled for 16 weeks, and they shot 29.
Wow. Wow.
So we lost 13 weeks out of our post schedule.
Right.
And yet we made it up anyway, because we locked the picture 1 month after the end of shooting. So that was pretty quick. It was due to, you know, a script that really worked well. And I don't know, everybody was sort of on board with the cut pretty much as it was. And it just, you know, sometimes pictures just work.
Definitely. I know there are some set photos of you actually on, especially the Echo Base set. And you mentioned that you were involved from day one. Was part of that being able to at least witness it firsthand, as opposed to coming in late like you did for Star Wars?
Well, I didn't go on location to Norway or Iceland. I forget where they shot. Norway, I think it was.
Right.
I was not on location in Norway that first week. It was all second unit stuff anyway. But I was, you know, around the set, and it took so long to set up these shots. Every shot had steam, or there would be hits on the wall. They'd have to, you know, to do a second take, they'd have to plaster and paint over the damage and then plant new explosives, you know. And I was only getting a very limited amount of film every day because everything was so complicated.
Right.
So very often I'd finish my work by midday and I'd wander over to the set. And they'd say, "What are you doing here?" And I'd say, "Well, I'm out of film. I need more film." And I'd hang around the set. So it was interesting. Editors tend to be kind of isolated, and
right.
Usually I think it's an advantage not to know what's going on the set, because the proper perspective that you have should be. You should only be able to see what the audience is going to see, and you should only know what the audience is going to know. So if you hear that somebody had a tantrum or terrible, or the lunch was terrible or whatever, it doesn't affect what the audience is going to see, you know. So it's really good to have distance from what's going on in the production, to be rigorous about it from an editorial standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
But on a personal standpoint, it's interesting to be around when they're shooting the movie, you know.
I would love to just briefly move to another collaboration that you had a strong tie to director-wise, which was John Hughes. And
yeah.
Two of my favorite comedies, you know, Ferris Bueller's Day Off and Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, you had such a pivotal role because, and you can explain probably better than I can, the role of editing in comedy is so much more important sometimes even than a drama or, you know, a science fiction film. But what was that process like, first working with John Hughes and then kind of cultivating this incredible relationship?
Well, John had worked with Dee Dee Allen and on Breakfast Club, and he decided that he only wanted to work with editors from New York.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I got the call, because I was from New York. And I learned from working with John that he had a very particular modus operandi, and that was that he would write these brilliant first drafts almost in a trance. He would have moments when he was possessed, and he was not to be disturbed. He would lock the door, and he would just write, and it was like he was taking dictation from his muse, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he would write these fantastic first drafts, but he would never edit them, and he wouldn't rewrite, and he wouldn't let anyone else rewrite either.
Uh-huh.
So the studio would have to say okay, and then so Ferris turned out to be, the first cut turned out to be 2 hours and 45 minutes long, and it was the longest first cut I had ever done in my life.
Yeah.
Usually when I work with Brian, it was always, he was always worried about the picture being too short, you know. Do we have enough yet? Can I stop shooting?
Uh-huh.
But with John, it was the opposite. So that was interesting, working with him to get Ferris down to size. And what was wonderful about Ferris is it all took place in one day, so there were no costume changes that we had to worry about.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody was wearing the same clothes. And you can move things around. And eventually we did the parade sequence, which ends the day before they go back home.
Right.
had come earlier, and we moved it later and moved the traffic jam up earlier than it had been, and we did a number of things. But essentially, there were a lot of speeches to camera, and too many of them, and we cut a lot of them out. So that's how we got down to fighting weight, you know.
Mm-hmm.
With Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, the first cut was 3 hours and 45 minutes.
Oh, wow.
And
oh,
wow. And they shot for 85 days. And each day that they shot, they were delivering 2 or 3 hours of dailies to the cutting room.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd come out of dailies, and I'd turn to the crew and I'd say, "We just watched more film for this one scene than the whole picture can run." So we finished the picture, and at the end of June, mm-hmm. And we were booked into, I don't know, 4,000 theaters in early November. Mm-hmm. So working backwards from that, you had to be mixing in October, which means you had to lock the picture in September. So now it was July 4th weekend. John goes away for 2 weeks. And the studio flipped out, but he was going to take a vacation. Mm-hmm. So he comes back after the vacation, and we start work on the film. And he had obviously been giving it some thought, and he said, all right, we're going to get rid of this, this, this. You know, mm-hmm. We go through the picture, we're pulling stuff out. Take this out. There are all these subplots about Steve Martin's wife suspects him of having an affair, and, mm-hmm. and we just take all that stuff out. And in one pass, we go from 3 hours and 45 minutes down to 2.5 hours.
Wow.
We took out a third of the picture in one pass.
Uh-huh.
And I said to John, I said, John, do you realize we just cut out 28 days of shooting?
Uh-huh.
And he just shrugged. Well, he didn't care. So then we got it down to about 2 hours, and we started to preview it, and we found that we had lots more work to do.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I could go on for a long time about this, but it's in my book.
Yes.
Eventually you'll read it.
Eventually.
But it's a good story, and he was a brilliant man and died way too soon. It's really a shame.
Yeah, a huge shame. Like you were mentioning... thank you so much for taking the time and talking through these incredible stories, and you've written these stories down.
The book is called A Long Time Ago in a Cutting Room Far, Far Away.
Put a link in the show notes so you can pre-order it right now. It's on Amazon, and hopefully before November we can talk even more to go into detail about a lot of these movies that we didn't even touch, incredible films that you worked on with De Palma, and I'm sure I can try to get a couple more Star Wars stories out of you when the time comes as well.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Hirsch, thank you so, so much. This was such an honor and such a treat, and it means a lot.
You're welcome.
We'll talk very soon.
All right. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye. I am so, so grateful to Mr. Hirsch for taking the time to tell these incredible stories from the editing bay. They were utterly fascinating, especially for the films that literally redefined how modern movies are edited. Even more stories can be found in his upcoming memoir, A Long Time Ago in a Cutting Room Far, Far Away, which is coming out in November. I've put the link in the show notes to pre-order it on Amazon, and you better believe that I already have my copy ordered. I hope we can have him on again soon to talk even more about his work on some of these iconic films. But until next week, stay tuned, leave a 5-star review, and as always, may the Force be with you.